It's the end of the fiscal year, and you're feeling it. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principal Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
Yeah, it's great to be back with you again, Barry, as
well,
always.
Well, it's great to be around. Now the summer has started. Kids are out of school. The temperature's rising. The grass is growing faster than you can keep up with. It's all good. Unless, of course, you happen to be a legislator, because the beginning of summer is usually when you're like looking to take off to get out of town, you know, get out of Dodge for a while and go back and do the parades and the fairs and the special events and the commemorative celebrations of various communities in your district. But our legislators and some others in other states are facing something that, well, Chuck, they shouldn't be surprised about. They're facing the fact that we have a bad economy. And that even with, and this is a blend of both Republican and Democrat controlled assemblies, they're starting to find out that the money just isn't there to fund all of the pet projects that they've been wanting to fund, or that their governor has been requesting to fund, that they've been funding now for the past number of years. Now, of course, here in Ohio, our budget process, we have to have a budget in place by the end of June because our fiscal year starts in July. Now, folks, you know, just kind of a quick primer, a fiscal year is the year that the government's year starts. Now, everybody else in the world, most human beings, run on what's called a calendar year, which means that January 1st is the new year. It's the start of the year. That's when everything kind of starts, and you look at, you do your 12-month projections out to the end of December, i.e., from winter to winter. Not so much with government, Chuck. In most governments, the fiscal year, the state-level governments, the fiscal year starts in the middle of the summer. July the 1st is the start of a new fiscal year. So when we, in about a week, when we reach the 1st of July, by the state's accounting, that is fiscal year 18. So they're already in 2018, 6 months early, i.e. they're going to be spending and paying out monies for the next 12 months going into the physical 2018 year. And so they started, and so their programs run from July to the end of June of the following year and go over and straddle a calendar year. Now, that's fine, but, you know, the other thing is that a number of states have a big portion of their budget made up by federal funds, and Ohio is among those states. As a matter of fact, looking at this recent budget that the Senate just yesterday, we're recording this on Thursday morning, so Wednesday night, the Senate passed out their version of the budget, which has $135 million in spending, in it, total spending, but that includes spending from the federal government monies coming in from grants and direct funding coming down from the feds. The only problem is that the federal fiscal year, okay, not to be confused with the state, not to be confused with the calendar year, the federal fiscal year starts on October the 1st and runs through the following September. So as you can see, there's 3 months between the beginning of the state fiscal year and the end of the federal fiscal year of the previous year. That can make for some interesting accounting, Chuck, if I guess I could say, because you have a situation where, yes, that money for 3 months, that federal money has already been pre-allocated, but if the feds during the month of June or July, and yes, they meet during those months, happen to process a budget or make changes to their spending for their next fiscal year, which starts in October. So the federal fiscal year of 2018 begins October 1st. If they make changes during the summer and that affects the amount of money that goes out in the next federal fiscal year in fiscal 2018 and beyond, then if the money gets changed, is something that a state has locked itself into expecting to be there at a certain rate, and it's not, what happens, Chuck?
crash and burn. I mean, essentially, they have to go, and in Ohio, the law says you will, period. So what does happen? I'm assuming the government just shuts down because there's no money.
Well, usually what they end up doing, though, that in a perfect world, that would be the case.
Yeah, if only. Yeah.
Yeah, they if they're that dependent upon federal funds, then they should shut down. But no, what usually ends up happening is that what happens is they come back and they pass a what they call a budget correction piece. In other words, we now know exactly how much more or less we're getting from the feds, and so now we're going to go in and tweak all these programs and either cut things or reshuffle monies or actually pad some of their bottom lines, depending on what they get. And so what you end up seeing is, and sometimes it happens right away, and sometimes because of carryovers and things, they know they've got a couple, 3 months to play. That new budget correction piece may not come out until the beginning of the calendar year. See? Now, that's where it really gets confusing. That's the reason why most people just throw up their hands and can't stand it, and they're apathetic toward government, is because government is a creature that runs much differently than we run. We can't do that. Chuck, if you know that a major client of yours is going to be stopping ordering from you on October the 1st, are you going to wait till January to make adjustments to your ordering and the expenses you got going out?
No. No, you make immediate. Because let me give you an example. My wife, I can't seem to get her to understand this, but when the price of crude oil goes up, even though that crude oil won't hit refineries until, maybe 6 months after it's pumped. If the price of crude goes up, the price of gasoline goes up immediately. Now, why is that? Well, because the refineries are anticipating the increased cost of the raw material, and they have to get the money in hand so they can pay for it when it arrives. Because, believe it or not, commodities like oil are a cash business. There's very little credit floating around. You got to pay for it when it comes in. This is kind of the same way that works. When I anticipate suddenly that that market is going away, we start looking at ways to broom out the remaining product at a reduced price to get something back out of it, hopefully our cost, and then we adjust our ordering for the next thing that's going to take its place. That's the way you do it in this and most other businesses.
Yeah, well, you have to do it that way. But government is a business unique to itself, and so they can set their own rules, and they can actually not even follow their own rules once they set them for everybody else. But we can talk about that later. But, okay, so in Ohio, we're getting through. The state is, and I'm sorry, I kind of convoluted a couple of numbers, and so let me go back and correct that. The amount that this budget would authorize in state spending or general revenue fund, that's the tax dollars we pay through our state taxes, would be $65.4 billion. That's for 2 years. $65.4 billion just from state resources. But when you add the federal, it almost doubles it to $132.7 billion. So that means that the state of Ohio is looking at having 47-48% of their budget being provided for by the federal government.
Yeah, what's wrong with this picture?
That's a recipe for quite a bit of disaster. Now, let's just say that 47% of your income was being provided by one purchaser, Chuck, in your company, and that purchaser decided to cut back 25%. What does that do to your income stream?
It basically makes me have to go out and find another job.
Right, because
to make the difference, yeah.
Let's say you're 48%, 25% of that is 12% of your budget. So you're basically taking a 12% income reduction over the term, and not counting the lost opportunities of being able to invest that money in other things or build your physical plan or doing other things that you could have done with that money that's now foregone. That's what we're looking at. I mean, folks, this is silly. It's just absolutely stupid that we've gotten to a point in many states where that's the way it looks, that nearly half or more than half, some in some states it's much more than half their budget is made up of federal sources, pots of money. And those pots of money all come with strings, and those strings all come with requirements that cost more money. And that's where we're, yeah, and that's what we're seeing. And of course, now you hear, and you'll hear the politicians in Columbus patting themselves on the back about how they cut spending and they reduced the agency lines by X percent. And I'll give the Ohio Senate credit. They had to. Revenue projections for the state have been off, Chuck. And it isn't, that isn't the federal fund stuff. That's the tax revenues coming in because, well, you can only tax people so much before they figure out something else to do. Either they cut their spending and don't buy as much, and so therefore you don't recoup those taxes. They find ways of investing their money to get to avoid taxes, or they pick up and leave.
Yeah, taxation.
And go to a state that doesn't have a personal income tax like Tennessee, which has been the recipient of quite a few Ohioans over the last few years.
Yeah.
Along with states like North Carolina, South Carolina, Florida, the snowbird country, whatever you want to call it. People get up and leave because what's the use of running a company or trying to raise a family in a state where they're basically just going to say, we just want more and more of your money.
Well,
and we're really not providing much more for you. We'll provide for all these other things that honestly aren't really something that you need to provide for because there's really no constitutional warrant for it. But let's go ahead and charge you more anyway. There are people who just say, enough's enough. I'm done with it. I'm out of here. Now, I really don't blame them. I mean, we've got friends who have picked up and left the state of Ohio because there are better opportunities elsewhere where they don't have to spend their time going over, sitting there filling out tax forms, figuring out how much money the local municipality that they didn't live in or don't live in and don't work in wants from them this year. I think you ran into that situation, didn't you?
Oh gosh, Barry, I've tried to explain this to people who think we don't pay enough taxes. I'm like, okay, what you have to understand is that taxation is a zero sum game. You have 100% of your salary to work with, your income, and the government can only take up to 100%. Now, what happens if the government takes 100% of your income? Oh, you'll die.
Then you either die or you become a complete dependent ward of the state, of the government.
And that's exactly what some people would like to do. You know, for instance, I had someone who decided in their infinite wisdom that they ran something from R. Lee Ermey, you know, the Sarge, if you will. Or if you know who R. Lee Ermey is.
Oh, yes.
R. Lee Ermey made some statement about everyone, there should be required 2 years of service to the country as a precursor to citizenship. Not just the Army. Army, Navy, Marines, some form of military service. And I said, okay, hold on. There's a problem with this. I already serve. The government takes about 40% of my income every year in one form or another. At minimum, 40+% is what I said. Now you want my body too? Well, the idea that somehow because I pay taxes but wasn't in the military, I don't serve? I'm sorry. That's sophistry. I do serve. I serve by being a productive citizen. Now, if you want to say that non-productive citizens should have to do that, well, I'd still argue against that. First of all, I don't want non-productive citizens in the military. Unless they just want to be career military. But second of all, I would say that I would be more than happy to serve in a state militia. No problem at all. And I mean a legitimate, not some kind of arbitrary thing that somebody's cooked up. I'm talking about a state militia where I would be defending hearth and home. I have no trouble with that at all. Although at this point, I think I'm too old to serve in a militia. In most states, when there were such a thing as a militia, 55 was normally the age limit. That's because us old guys can't go lay in a ditch when it's 20 below zero without having the unfortunate habit of dying. But that being said, we have to understand that 100% of your income is the maximum amount that you can get. And what happens when you start to get in the 50% range? We already know this because we've been there and we're not that far away right now. What happens when you get in the 50% range? Well, the curves start getting really ugly because people start cheating and revenue actually falls off. Well, why is that? Let me ask you, in a graduated income tax where you take more and more and more of people's income as they make more and more and more money, you take a larger and larger and larger percentage.
Right.
What does that do to people's mentality? You start saying you stop work and doing things like working overtime because that'll throw me into another bracket and I'll actually make less money by working 30 hours more this week. I will take home less money because I'm in a different tax bracket.
Then we become like France.
Exactly. It kills incentive. Yeah, it kills incentive.
It does.
And that's what the state and the federal government are in the middle of doing. They're in the middle of killing incentive again. We had this in the 70s. I'm trying to remember what the top tax bracket was. It was around 80%. If you made over a certain amount of money, you just paid 80% of your income. And a place of Sweden at one time, Sweden, they ran off Ingmar Bergman, who was a famous film director, a big deal. They ran him off because essentially they had a 110% tax bracket. What did you make? Send it in and add a 10%. Incentive is killed off by government taxation. And basically what we've got is a situation right now. I'm seeing very strange things that are talking about the fact that, for instance, in Kansas, look how bad supply side did in Kansas. They cut taxes and then there was this terrible trouble. They didn't have enough revenue to run the government. And my first response was, did you cut spending when you cut taxes? Because if you'll recall, in the 80s, when Ronald Reagan's tax cuts hit, there was supposed to be concomitant spending cuts to pay off the deficit. Well, what happened?
Right. Well, that's usually the way it's supposed to work.
Yeah, and what actually happened was, as the revenues increased from the tax cuts, and yes, folks, when you cut marginal rates within bounds, revenues go up. In fact, the revenue to the federal government doubled. Now, what happened? Who was in charge of Congress where spending bills start during the 1980s when Ronald Reagan was president? It was Democrats. The Democratic Party was in control. They controlled really the budget strings.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Yeah, the Democratic Party controlled the budget strings. What did they do? They saw that revenue. They rubbed their hands together, kind of like that. Can you hear my hands rubbing together? And went, oh boy, look at all that money. Let's spend it. Did they pay off debt like they were supposed to? That was the whole point. No. Yeah, they retired debt. And then they picked up more debt. Way, 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 way more debt. So in Kansas, we're seeing kind of the same thing. Did they cut spending? No, they didn't cut any spending. They continued merrily along. And this is not a Democratic disease. This is also a Republican disease, which I think is your point.
Right, because in Kansas, the legislature is mainly controlled by Republicans. And the governor, Sam Brownback, the former senator, is a Republican as well. Now, the problem with the Kansas thing is that, and we almost had that problem here in Ohio because the Democrats in the Ohio Senate were gunning to rescind what they considered to be the only thing that was wrong with our budget, and that was a tax cut or tax relief that was passed a couple of years ago that basically allowed businesses that have under $250,000 of income an ability to not have to pay taxes. In other words, your taxable income doesn't start if you're an LLC or other closely held company until you reach $250,000. And honestly, there's an awful lot of businesses in this state, Chuck, that really run on smaller margins. Their revenues may not go to $250,000 a year. I mean, you're probably blessed to be one of the big boys who's above that.
Oh, rate, yeah, but, we're a big boy.
My poor little company, doesn't see that number. But that's something that the legislature decided a couple of years ago to pass. And what they've been seeing is that they're getting reports back from a lot of businesses that has allowed them to be able to grow their businesses, to expand, actually to maybe bring on and employ people because they've been able to save some of that money back in order to make those investments. And you know, like I said, if the government's not taking your money, you have more liberty in order to actually do things, especially as a business owner or business leader, to create avenues of providing more tax dollars to the government through hiring employees or other ways, or buying, if it's sales tax, buying certain pieces of equipment or supplies or material, things of that nature. And that's how you stimulate an economy, is by letting the free market stimulate the economy, not by basically saying, no, we're going to control and regulate you to death, and then we're going to raise your taxes because we don't have enough money coming in to provide for all the programs that we want to control. And that's what happened in Kansas, is that the governor had passed a bunch of income tax cuts, and then they ran into some fiscal issues just like everybody else is, because the economy's weak. So instead of saying, yeah, let's cut back on our spending, they're like, no, let's get rid of the tax cuts. And so they did. And the governor vetoed that. And they went back and they passed a veto override. And so now, if you're a business or an individual in Kansas, you've just lost over $1.2 billion in tax cuts because your Republican legislature is acting like a bunch of progressives and believes that they can spend your money better than you can, and they can do more to stimulate the economy through government than businesses can. Now, Chuck, definition of insanity is doing the same thing you've always done, the same way you've always done it over and over again, and expecting a different result.
Yep.
How do you think it's going to work out for them?
Well, this isn't going to work out at all. We're going to be essentially in the same boat as California, Illinois, and several other states who are running their budgets this way, which is essentially on the verge of bankruptcy, because you simply cannot continue to spend and spend and spend and spend and spend, despite Keynesian economics theory that says, you know, governments can spend themselves into prosperity, which is an absurd, it's an absurd position that's been proven that it doesn't work. And it's proving it out itself again that it doesn't work. When are we going to drop that particular absurd line of reasoning?
Well, if that held true, Chuck, I'd be a billionaire right now.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah. Well, here's the problem. You could have been a billionaire in Germany and still been eating potato soup. If you'll recall, during the hyperinflation period, people were being paid in cash by the wheelbarrow full, millions and billions of Deutschmarks, and workers demanded to be paid twice a day because the inflation, the prices in the morning might be double what they were in the evening. Or, I mean, vice versa. In the evening might be double what they were in the morning. Now, those kind of things tend to stop themselves. Hyperinflation periods tend to be short-lived because what it leads to is essentially open riots in the streets. Okay, what you're seeing in Venezuela is essentially, it should be one of the most prosperous countries in the world. They're sitting on a virtual lake of crude oil. Instead, what happens? You have a government that decides to do cradle to grave, all things to all people. And what happens? It's bankrupt. You can't get toilet paper in Venezuela. People are eating garbage in the streets, and no garbage is being picked up because nobody can afford to run the trucks. Why? Because they adopted this kind of spending and taxing practice. It wasn't enough that Hugo Chavez basically nationalized the oil companies. He nationalized everything, and in fact, all kinds of American corporations either saw the writing on the wall and quick got out of Venezuela, which, of course, is also bad for the economy, or they got their assets seized. And now, easily, nobody knows how to run the equipment because all the people say executives are useless. No, they know how the business runs. They may not know how the machinery of the business, but they know how the business end runs. That's the problem. Everybody has to be a part of the machine or the machine stops running.
That's true.
And that's what's going on here. Basically, Ohio is taxing its thinking and entrepreneurial class out of the state.
Well, they've been trying to do that. That's part of the reason why the Democrats pushed to try to repeal those tax cuts to small businesses was a really stupid thing to do. And, of course, the legislature, the Senate, rejected that idea out of hand because the Democrats proposed an alternative budget. And, of course, you know, that was just mainly for show. For people who haven't been following, our Ohio Senate has 33 members, 9 of whom are Democrats. In other words, the Democrats don't even have a large enough caucus to vote as a block and actually stop anything from happening, because it only takes 17 votes out of 33 in order to pass something. And so there's no way the Democrats have any way of blocking, but every once in a while the Republicans will do something and throw the Democrats a bone or two. And they got a vote out of it this time. Sandra Williams from Cleveland voted for that budget because they added funding, i.e. more spending, to fund literacy programs in certain areas in Cleveland, where she happens to represent. So, in other words, they bought her with pork. Big problem is again, that's still that same mentality of we can continue to spend. They're bragging that, yeah, not only did we bring the budget into fix, but we gave the House $3 million worth of wiggle room if they want to add some things. In other words, they're saying you've got $3 million of flexibility if you want to spend more money. Now, when I'm looking at that, Chuck, that's just, in one sense, it's irresponsible. They're all patting themselves on the back because, oh, we averted disaster, and our revenue projections, because people are not spending, were for the last 10 months have been off by the state's Office of Budget Management's projections. They've been way off to the tune of, we have $1.2 billion less coming in than they expected. So the governor's budget was fat. And so they've been trimming and things. And of course, they, you know, all the agencies, they rolled them back 3-5%, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, the finance chairman of the Senate bragged on the floor yesterday that they'd cut the Senate's budget by 6%. Well, that's not really all that hard to do. And those are not really cuts. Those are reductions in the increases that were being offered by the governor's budget. That's the thing that gets me, is that spending hasn't changed. That $132.4 billion is still a boatload of money, considering the fact that you have states like, well, West Virginia, which is close to me. They're finishing their budget process now for the second time, because the first time around, their governor vetoed the budget in a very unprofessional manner by staging a press conference and setting the budget document on a table and then dropping an actual cow patty on it. So... I kid you not. This is somebody who considers themselves to be a professional and mature doing something that stupid, and then called them back into special session. Of course, they've now passed the budget again. It's going back to their governor. Chuck, their budget, $4.22 billion. Ohio's budget, just the state level, $65 billion. So in other words,
15
more
times,
than...
Yeah. 15 times 14, the amount.
15
yeah.
times the amount that we're spending. And that's just the state level. Now, of course, you know, West Virginia's got 3 million inhabitants and Ohio's got 11, so that's about 4-1. But still, we're spending 5 times more than they are.
But West Virginia has a lot more raw material wealth than we have.
They do, yes.
But
of course, most of that raw material is in the form of coal. Which is basically being destroyed by federal regulatory proposals coming out of the DC, or had been up until the Obama law, or, you know, left and Trump won, and supposedly there's going to be a reprieve for coal, so maybe they're going to be seeing some better days. But I honestly, Chuck, you know, we have to be careful here in Ohio about not being too happy about our setup here great, we're wonderful here, we've done so much, it's been, you know, we've done everything right, and look at us, we cut budget, we're still spending more than we should, because they can run in to be like Illinois. And of course, what's happening in Illinois right now, Chuck?
Oh, well, they're virtually bankrupt.
That's right, they're virtually bankrupt. As a matter of fact, it's getting close to Illinois defaulting.
Very close. Yeah.
On everything.
Yep.
As a matter of fact, John Cass, who's a reporter for the Chicago Tribune, and this was in the Tribune on Thursday, opens an article saying, Illinois is like Venezuela now, a fiscally broken state that has lost its will to live, although for the moment, we still have enough toilet paper.
Yeah. Exactly.
So, you know, this is the situation, like a state. But of course, Illinois is run by a bunch of progressive leftists. I mean, their governor, their legislature, and of course, although he gets a shout out in this article, it's really Rahm Emanuel, who's the mayor of Chicago. And basically, you know, this columnist for the Trib This is a funny, it's one sense it's tongue in cheek, but his proposal is, what do we do with a broken Illinois? Let's dissolve it. Let's get rid of it. So, because, you know, the politicians meeting in Springfield are going to be posturing, gesturing, and blaming, we actually need a plan. He's like, decommission the state, tear up the charter, whatever the legal mumbo jumbo is, just end the whole thing. We just disappear with no pain. That's right. You heard me. Break it into pieces right now. And there's a little map of the proposed new map.
Yeah.
And it's funny. Southern Wisconsin, Eastern Iowa, Northeastern Missouri, Western Kentucky, and Western Indiana all grow quite a bit. But there are still two plots of land that are held out from this new distribution. And one is a 40-acre plot of land called Ramonia, because Rahm Emanuel needs to have a little kingdom to run. And then the other plot is a plot the size of a case of soft drinks. You know what a size of a case is. You know, that's not very big. Because the Cook County Board President, Tony Preckwinkle, is pushing for taxing on soda pop. And so Cass says, give her this grant of land as large as a case of the soda pop she taxes, that she might stand on it and proclaim herself queen of Taxwinkletopia.
Yeah, Taxwinkletopia, because Tony.
Then there's already another place that nobody doesn't want. And he's like, you already know the name of that wasteland, and that's Madiganistan, because Madigan is the Democrat Party chairman in Illinois, who's basically presiding over all of the politicians in Illinois who have spent their way into basically what is an untenable situation. They have $251 billion in unfunded public union pension liabilities, Chuck.
Yeah, they're in bad shape.
$251 billion just in pension liabilities, and that doesn't count anything else. So he goes into this article. It's great. We'll have it up on our website. It'll be linked. But this is a great article about, you know, let's just divide it up. And I know some people have said before, you know, you talk about, you know, you cut California off, do this. If Cleveland doesn't like the rest of Ohio, then, you know, let Cleveland go to Michigan, that kind of stuff. Let Toledo go to Michigan, whatever it might be. But really, those proposals are not going to fly, because the only thing that really can be done at that point is somebody to grow up and put on their big boy pants. Yeah. And realize, we just can't spend this anymore. We can't buy votes anymore with programs. Yes, we have some intractable problems. And Ohio is dealing with some serious intractable problems, Chuck. I mean, our economy is starting to, you know, do a flip-flop. We've got a huge drug crisis in this state, opioids and everything else. And the addiction numbers are off the charts, you know, especially in my part of the state.
Yeah.
You know, we have beat up farmers to the point where we almost have no agricultural production left in the state anymore. Now, we do have, but thankfully, they one of the tweaks that they made was to change the formula on the agricultural use so that farmers weren't actually paying double and triple what they've been paying over the next 3 years.
Well,
which would basically have run most of them out of business.
The family farm is essentially gone. I mean, we all know people who do it, but you have to be a corporate farmer anymore to make money at it.
Yeah. It's very, very hard for anybody who's a family farmer. And honestly, and the other problem with that is, because it's so hard, that when the kids growing up see it, they oftentimes are looking at that like, I'm not sure I want to take on that kind of pressure and that kind of, you know, and I can go to school or I can go out and work another job and not work the farm and, you know, try to better myself that way.
Who wants to work 80-hour weeks and have $20,000 in profit?
Yep. That's exactly right. And most people don't want to do that.
No.
Yep. Well, you know, I want to jump off of a budget piece here for a minute, because there's a couple of things we want to talk about before we finish up today. And one is, and we'll get to it here in a second, on the Georgia 6th District congressional race, which, surprise, the Democrats missed again. But I want to talk about something here, because, you know, we're talking about funding and for agencies. Here's one that basically I'm really kind of surprised, but in one sense I'm kind of not, because I know who's pulling strings behind the scenes over in the governor's office. that a state agency in Ohio is out there publicly promoting LGBT Pride Month. Yes, that's right. The homosexual pride, you saw the articles and papers probably about the marches and things and the uproar. And I think, you know, during the Columbus one this last week, there was some Black Lives Matter protesters who actually clashed with the homosexual activists. So, there's an awful lot of turmoil there. But one of the things that you really don't expect is to open your browser when you're going to a state agency's website to try to find information about X, Y, and Z. And the first thing you see is a big rainbow flag and a promotion of National LGBT Pride Month. But that's what you saw when you go to the Ohio Department of Health's website this week. ODH.ohio.gov, if you go over there, they've got a scrolling bar that flashes across the screen at the very top about the various health issues that they're dealing with. And you've got things like, you know, mosquito control because of West Nile virus and lead hazards from old paint in old houses, and all of the other things that a health department should be concerned about. And then you see this thing with a rainbow flag banner that says June, National LGBT Pride Month. And so I was alerted to this by an activist friend of mine. So late yesterday afternoon, I went over and I clicked on it, and sure enough, it pops up. Now, Chuck, if you're an average person and you're thinking, okay, our state Department of Health, and you figure out what their mission statement should be or what they're concerned about, and you see that they're drawing attention to homosexuality and this whole issue with this National LGBT Pride Month article. What do you expect that they're going to be talking about as relation to the Department of Health?
Well, you would think that they would be talking about the number one health problem that homosexuals have, and that is the STDs and, in fact, increased death, the increased death rate that homosexuals have from engaging in the activities that they engage in, caused by diseases and damage that they do to one another, especially male-male contact.
Right. You would expect that. And so let me read you what the Department of Health has to say about National LGBT Pride Month. And here's what they start their article out with. It says, quote, June 1st marked the beginning of National LGBT Pride Month, as hundreds of events around the country this month show their support and celebrate LGBT rights. There's another problem there. It's important to recognize one of the LGBT community's largest health problems. Tobacco.
Smoking, yeah.
That's right, folks. That's what the Department of Health, that was their hook in order to promote the National LGBT Pride Month and to talk about homosexual rights is a... basically, maybe more than tangential, but I would say tangential connect between the number of people who smoke cigarettes in this supposed community versus the general population. You know, basically, they're like, oh, this that many among these many communities that make up the population, this one, the LGBT community, continues to smoke at significantly higher rates than the rest of the country. Okay, yeah, that's may be true. But honestly, is that the biggest health issue among this community? Chuck, I think you're right. No, it goes back to the transference of disease and other things related to the unsafe practices and the perverted practices of homosexuality. And then you see the other things that go on and stress. And oh, maybe that's it. Because you're doing something that is abhorrent to God, because you're doing something that is unnatural, you have stress. And in order to relieve your stress, you smoke. Because a lot of people use smoking as stress relief, although it really doesn't help because it raises your blood pressure and everything else. But maybe that's the reason why smoking is more prevalent in that community. And so what is the department doing with this? Oh, well, you know, we want to make sure that we reach out to them. So we're going to attend the 2017 Columbus Pride Festival, which was this last weekend, and they had put up a booth so that they could provide information on tobacco prevention and cessation. And then, and they also have fun giveaway items for attendees to take home. Chuck, giveaway items? Where do you think the Department of Health got those? Well, more specifically, who paid for those?
Yeah. Yeah.
The Ohio taxpayers.
Yep.
Because they're a state agency. Okay, so basically that's their big thing was it's all about tobacco. It has nothing to do, because the Department of Health, who's supposedly supposed to check and help, you know, bring responses to bringing disease rates down and stopping things like, chlamydia, gonorrhea, HIV, HPV, yeah, all of these fun things. Nope, tobacco, because, you know, we got to be politically correct. We can't actually go out and talk and address the main issue. We just don't while you're infecting yourselves, we just don't want you to smoke.
Yeah,
folks, do us a favor. Contact the Department of Health. Contact the governor's office, and just tell them how ridiculous this is. First of all, this is a state agency actually promoting a lifestyle and actual personal choices that are health damaging and health destroying, but yet they're doing it under the guise of, well, we're just trying to keep people from smoking. Really? Come on. Let's not kid ourselves. This may be one of the reasons why the former director of the department, Rick Hodges, who was conservative and who was, I believe, a believer, left all of a sudden earlier this year. And, of course, they have an interim director right now. It may be that it just was too much for them to deal with. Didn't want to go there.
Well,
but, that's really – the department has not had a problem with going there, it looks
so,
like.
So what you're saying is
– and my thought is if they're going to address the LGBT community, address them on the issues that are they're the major things. Yeah, they may actually smoke more and they may have instances of long-term – issues like cancer, but if you're dying from disease related to HIV and other sexually transmitted diseases and you're dying earlier, shouldn't that be a bigger focus of the department than tobacco cessation among LGBT?
You would think. Barry, what you just pointed out is that the swamp just doesn't need to be drained in Washington, D.C. It also needs to be drained in Columbus, Ohio.
Right, because you got those mosquitoes with the West Nile virus.
Yeah. and you've also got people entrenched in agencies in Columbus who want to willfully ignore the forest for the trees.
Yes,
the trees being smoking. The forest is the fact that homosexuals live overall, on average, very short lifespans, largely due to disease, self-medication with drugs, several different factors that they're completely ignoring. If you want, in the heterosexual community, you know, they're not targeting anybody specifically in the heterosexual community. What's the big push? Smoking is one of the things they're worried about. But what's their big push? Heart disease. Fitness, that kind of thing. And then also other diseases that come along with, longevity. It used to be in the old days, people, for the most part, the average age was much shorter. And that's because a lot of children died. And also because a lot of people died of disease. Well, we don't have that anymore. People now live into their 80s and 90s and live to be 100. And when you live to be 100, you've got a greater chance of catching some deadly disease like cancer or heart disease. I mean, those are the facts, folks. And this is the problem. We have people who are very willing to overlook the forest in favor of the trees.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I guess that one of the other things that people are talking about today, and honestly we can talk about it some, and that is the non-surprise of a Republican actually winning the Georgia 6th Congressional District. Billed as the biggest, most expensive U.S. House race in history, the special runoff election in Georgia's 6th Congressional District, which is basically Atlanta and its suburbs, pitted Republican Karen Handel, who was the Secretary of State of Georgia, against Democrat progressive liberal John Ossoff. Ossoff had actually bested Handel in the special election, but because neither one of them had won a clear majority, there was a runoff. Well, the Democrats saw that as a way of actually, you know, creating this, you know, or building up on this meme that they're trying to create, that it's all a referendum on the fact that Donald Trump's president and people hate Trump so much that we're going to win all these races. Well, that hadn't worked for them three times prior to this race. They had lost a number. We talked about some of those races. They had lost those, you know, even with one with one of the candidates assaulting a media reporter the day before the election. They still couldn't.
That may have gotten him a few extra votes. Who knows?
Yeah, but in this one, the Democrats spent over $30 million and then some on trying to get John Ossoff to take out Karen Handel. What happened? Well, Tuesday was the election, and Tuesday night I'm watching. The New York Times has this little thing where they have all these graphs and charts, and they've got like a little meter that tells you what the, by their projections of the number of what's been reported, who's got the edge and the advantage. And it was so much fun because there was nowhere during the entire night. But at the end of the night, it turned out that the most expensive house race in history was basically pretty much all over but the crying. Karen Handel basically beat John Ossoff by almost 4 points. This was in a district that, again, has Metro Atlanta, which is not conservative, but has a couple of Cobb County, DeKalb County, Fulton County are all kind of in that district.
Right, Tri-County area, and north end of it. Of
yeah,
Atlanta.
Exactly. Yeah. And basically what happened was, well, Republicans turned out to vote, Chuck. Now, it was interesting because one of the things that the Times, because they have early voting during this election, and of course the Democrats were really pounding early voting. They were pounding it. And you know what? If it had stopped at early voting, John Ossoff would have won because he was besting Karen Handel by about 1,500 votes in the early voting. When they counted the early vote that day, he was up on her by 1,500 votes. There was quite a bit of turnout in early voting. But when it got right down to it, bam, it was a 4-point smack, and 4 points is actually pretty significant.
Well, it's not.
Even though that's a district that the Republicans won handily the prior time, when you're talking about how much money and attention the Democratic Party was throwing into that race, a 4-point win by the Republican is actually somewhat of a smackdown.
Here's the problem, Barry. Now, you said $30 million. The latest number I heard was the Democrats spent $50 million in that district.
And you know what? I'm looking at something here, and I was wrong. It's $30 million was the television buy.
Yeah. That was the TV buy.
Yeah,
$50 million.
Yeah, you're
$50
right.
Million.
It was $50 million.
They spent $50 million.
$30 million of it was just their media buy.
Yeah, if you figure... it was somebody had done the math, and I have to double check this math, but the last time I heard was the Democrats spent $3 per voter in a losing effort. I think that number's low, like way low. In any case, they're trying to claim some kind of victory because they spent $50 million and lost in a district. They lost by 4 points instead of 20. Normally, this district will elect a Republican by double digits. Okay. Now, I'm reading an article. I'm sort of laughing about an article I'm reading, and it shouldn't shock you. I laugh about a lot of stuff that I read in Politico. Okay. Because it's just logically none of it follows. And what else is new with Politico? Not much follows. But they're really surprised because here's what really happened in the election, Barry. Republicans showed up to vote. Nobody expected that. Nobody expected Republicans to show up and vote. Seriously. The pollsters all said nobody will show up to vote. What? In a special election that's being touted as a bellwether on whether Trump will be able to complete his agenda or not, Republicans aren't going to show up and vote? I'm seriously having major trouble following the absurd quote-unquote logic of the writer, Stephen Shepard, in Politico. And again, we will post this. But the pollsters all got it wrong. Well, what else is new, Barry? When was the last time the pollsters got it right in an election recently? They've been wrong all along. And there's a reason for that. Pollsters are, for the most part, relying on old-style media. They want to do phone polling. Well, who has a telephone anymore that hangs on the wall in their house? And those are the only phones that most people get polled on, or the ones that still have them in their house.
Right, or the ones who actually, the cell numbers are out there, and they take the phone calls because they're willing to do it, which means that they're not the average voter.
Well, basically what they're saying is, well, Republicans are telling us lies. Well, of course they are. Okay, why would I always lie to pollsters all the time. Why? Why? Because nobody likes them. Nobody likes them. Nobody likes being bothered by them. I either lie to them or I really smack them around and tell them when I get a call. And I don't anymore because I don't have a phone that hangs on the wall anymore. I have a cell phone. When I was getting them, I used to have a blast with pollsters. Absolute blast with pollsters. Because I would say, well, you know, I know who you're working for. And they'd go, well, really? Because I don't know. And I'd say, I can tell from the questions you're asking. You're conducting a push poll. You're trying to push me to a certain opinion. I'm not going to give you that. Or if the election were held today, would you vote for blah or blah? And I'm like, well, those aren't my only two choices, are they? Yes. Well, I'm not going to vote for either one of them. Well, if you were to vote for one of these two candidates, which one? I said, neither. So you're not going to vote? No, I'm going to vote for someone else. Well, that's not part of your choice. We want to know. We want to know which one you would most likely vote for. I said, neither. This is the kind of polling that gets done. Yeah. This is the kind of polling that gets done, which is why...
Right. If they were the last two people on the ballot on the face of the planet, they're not getting...
Yeah, that's exactly right. They're not getting my vote. So, I had to laugh about this because here's what the Democratic hope was. Democrats say they hope Trump's low approval ratings mean voters will swing toward, not against, their candidates in the closing days of elections to come. But that doesn't seem to have happened in Georgia or in Wyoming or in, I think, South Carolina or many of the other places that have had special elections, even though Trump lagged behind other Republicans there in last year's presidential election. Trump only won this district by 1 point. This district that we're talking about in Georgia. Okay.
Yep.
Barry, if Democrats say they hope Trump's low approval rating means voters will swing toward, not against, their candidates, they're counting on polls that are proving to be flawed. A, polls that say that Trump isn't popular. Do I believe polls that are telling me Trump's approval ratings are in the dumper? No, I don't believe them. Why? Because they're using the same polling methods that they used to say that Hillary was going to win by a landslide. This is the problem. Polling needs to revamp itself, and it stops needing to be so partisan. If you want real polling, then develop new methods. Now, if you want to win elections, you can't simply have "We Hate Trump" as your campaign, the entire center of your campaign. It's not going to work out for you. You have to have an agenda, and you have to have something you can sell people. You know, this thing, "We're going to get Trump," doesn't seem to be gathering votes. Yeah, it got a lot of Hollywood people to come out of the woodwork and go down and glad hand down in the district. It got a lot of people to cough up money into the Democratic election coffers, which cost them $50 million, for which they got nothing. They need to rethink what they're doing. And they're starting to get the picture, maybe, that they've missed the boat on, because they're losing blue-collar workers. And why are they losing blue-collar workers as support? They're losing blue-collar workers as support because blue-collar workers are losing their jobs to people who are coming in the country illegally. They don't like that. And jobs that are being exported.
Now, Chuck, I got to stop you right there, because it's obvious that you're just not as tuned in politically as some others are, because we know it has nothing to do with any of those factors.
Right.
Now, we should stop and listen carefully to Rachel Maddow from MSNBC, because she's put her finger on the pulse trigger of why the Democrats lost in the Georgia election last night. And it has nothing to do with the changing of political sentiments and people being frustrated and the tax and spend, you know, messages and the progressive leftist embrace of perversions and everything else by the Dems. Here's how Rachel Maddow put it as she was talking to election analyst Steve Kornacki on her program. And she says, quote, "Steve, let me ask you one last question on this. If there was a turnout effect from the bad weather today in the district, does that have any partisan implications that you could foresee in terms of what was expected for same day election day voting rather than the early vote?" So in other words, what Rachel Maddow was asking is it the rain? Did the rain make Democrats not want to come out to vote? That's what she was asking. And of course, Kornacki comes back and says, "Well, you can attribute that to anything. We'll see if that turns out, but there's something that's something else. And obviously, if you get into an election like this where it's going to be decided by a point or two, you can blame anything, whichever side you turn up on," unquote. So really, he was kind of smacking her down, like,
yeah,
"Oh, that was stupid."
I wondered what his reply would be. Like, yeah, it's a dumb question, and here's an answer that's going to make you look even more idiotic than you made yourself look with that question.
And the big problem was, it wasn't so much because, again, their bigger problem was they spent so much money on early voting that they got the low-hanging fruit. They got the people who didn't want to be bothered going to the poll that day. And so they went out. So, but they couldn't get the ones who, A, didn't want to be bothered, and B, didn't want to even be bothered to go early vote somewhere because it was, you know, didn't feel like it was convenient for them. Because the turnout in this special election, Chuck, 260,000 votes.
Yeah.
Okay? That's bigger than their midterms. There was historic turnout in this particular special election. So I don't think the rain Rachel Maddow is talking about had anything whatsoever to do with the turnout. What did turn out was that people are repudiating the progressive leftist identity politics, social justice warrior, we're smarter than you are and we can spend your money better than you program of the left.
Yeah.
It's really, and this honestly, you know, there are tests, but most of these tests so far have been in districts where the seats were held by Republicans. And so having a Republican win isn't necessarily the big story. It's having the Democrats spend so much money, time, and effort and banking on all these pollsters and still losing.
Yep.
That's really the big, big story.
That is the big story.
And that's the reason why the rumblings today, although they probably won't act on it for a little while yet, the rumblings now are, should Nancy Pelosi continue to keep her seat as the minority leader in the House of Representatives.
Well, I'd love to go into that. And guess what? We are out of time.
We're out of time.
We are out of time. Okay, you know what we think. We want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. That's www.principledpolicy.com. And join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.